Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi.
Siri. Welcome to High Theory.
In this podcast, we get high on the substance of theory.
I'm Sharunik Boshu.
And I'm Kim Adams.
We are two tired academics trying to save critique from itself.
Hello, and welcome to High Theory. Today we are talking with Greg Vargo about melodrama. Before we begin, Greg, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yes, I am a faculty member in the English department at NYU, and I am a scholar of 19th century British culture, and specifically work on political movements, working class culture, performance, the novel, print culture, and a variety of things.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming to High Theory. So let me start off by asking you a question that I think many of us have wondered from time to time, which is, what the heck is melodrama?
Yeah, well, melodrama is many things. It's a theatrical genre that emerges in the decade following the French Revolution and dominates the stage in Britain and the United States, for that matter, for nearly a century. It's a form that's marked very much by its origin. Sir Walter Scott complained of the moral Jacobinism of melodrama, in that it seems to take the side of the oppressed and tell stories of common people, suffering the machinations of elite villains. But more than its overt politics, it's a genre of crisis, and it invites audiences to participate in the experience of crisis, which it does through any number of ways, but through a kind of use of hyperbolic language, extreme situations, extraordinary coincidences, stark oppositions, and a vision of the world marked by what Peter Brooks calls a moral Manichaeism. And then finally, it's a genre that's an effect of state regulation. Theater is the only art form in Britain subject to statutory censorship in a regime of regulation that exists until the 1960s. That has a kind of a complex history, but melodrama kind of emerges out of the restriction of the performance of the so-called legitimate genres of comedy and tragedy to a few select theaters possessing a royal patent. And so it's kind of one of the many innovative forms that emerge to kind of get around that restriction. But it means kind of, where you watch theater and what kind of theater you actually attend means what you can actually see.
Right. If I'm understanding correctly, in the 18th and 19th centuries, melodrama carries a kind of distinct political energy that other genres at the same time don't carry.
Yes. And it certainly has a complex politics and one that's disputed, but I would claim yes. And in part from, theater becomes highly politicized through the regime of censorship and restriction. It's a genre that kind of crosses class barriers, but that, it has kind of laboring people as its kind of primary audience. And it responds very quickly sometimes to kind of all the dislocations that we think of as part of 19th century life, whether, you know, factories or enclosure or, you know, any number of crises, and kind of takes on as slavery, takes on these topical questions in a way that other theatrical forms might kind of skirt.
Right. And then, you know, and maybe I can also come back to this question in the end, but I think it makes sense to ask it now, which is right now you're working specifically on what you term melodramas of race or race melodramas. So,
yeah, well, I'm specifically interested in the career of an African-American actor by the name of Ira Aldridge, moves to Britain in the mid-1820s and performs there for the rest of his life. He's actually a New Yorker, may have performed at the African Theater in this city, which is harassed and ultimately closed through racist repression. But he becomes a very famous and very successful actor that, though, obviously navigates a theater industry that's marked by its own racial politics. And you know, sometimes early in his career, particularly, suffers a racial abuse. And one of the ways that directors of the theater industry in Britain mark his career in terms of its racial politics is he performs in a relatively narrow repertoire of shows for 40 years. And so he performs Othello, course, and other 17th century tragedies early 18th century, like the Revenge. But then he also performs kind of overwhelmingly in slavery melodramas and racial melodramas, such as a play called The Slave and The Black Doctor, which the publisher, John Dix, who produces Penny Plays, actually puts his name onto in a later edition because he's so strongly associated with the role. So it kind of raises a host of interesting questions. I mean, Saida Hartman sees these racial melodramas as part of the scenes of subjection that she articulates, where kind of Black suffering is foregrounded. But, you know, it's they're also kind of scenes of revolt often enough. I think they appeal to Aldridge, not kind of simply as a kind of a pandering to British audiences, because the repertoire includes these Black figures in revolt, that become a kind of dynamic way of thinking about the history of abolition. I mean, he's performing right as abolition occurs in 1833, but then kind of abolition era plays he'll kind of keep in the repertoire for 20 or 30 more years. And so, you know, I kind of think about it, these plays as kind of countering an abolitionist narrative where the gift of freedom is kind of brought by a paternalistic, benevolent government to enslave people. Yeah. And rather they're kind of stories where revolutionary emancipation plays a certain role in winning freedom.
How do you use melodrama? And let me add maybe a clause or two to that question, which is really what you already, I think, have begun talking about, is to kind of read by the use of the history of a genre or by the use of performance history to read, you know, histories of the abolition movement, history of race relations. So kind of to bring all of those together into the main category of use. So how do you use melodrama in your own work that you're doing right now, or, you know?
Yeah, well, many scholars are doing a lot with melodrama, and it's really been a central category for thinking about 19th century culture Rowan McWilliams kind of writes about a melodramatic turn among historians, which has allowed a kind of focus on questions of emotion and gender and populism. So some of historians' kind of preoccupations over the last couple of decades. And it's certainly been a powerful way to kind of think about domains of culture outside of theater. So for instance, people might look at political rhetoric that uses kind of sharp dichotomies and moral absolutes and think about that as occurring in a melodramatic mode. My approach, though, is somewhat different, and I try to wed a social history with kind of cultural or theatrical history, and so ask what ordinary people actually do with literature or performance, and in particular, how these things worked in activist campaigns. A central structure of a Victorian theater is the so-called benefit night, which are nights in which performers earned a fairly substantial fraction of their yearly salary by sharing ticket sales. And then this was kind of extended beyond culture workers. And it wasn't just actors, but like the band or even the ticket takers might get a benefit night. But it extended beyond culture workers to charitable organizations. And then activist groups radicalized this tradition and had benefit nights for things like political prisoners and strike funds or to pay for demonstrations or to erect a kind of union hall or whatever goal they had in mind. And so I'm kind of interested in these histories of performance and what groups, you know, were actually doing with the genres. And, right. You know, they do a lot of different things, of course, from political education to raising money to a form of propaganda. But also, you know, I work most centrally on a movement for civil rights known as Chartism. And I found over 100 instances of dramatic performance, either at commercial theaters or kind of amateur performance within the Chartist movement. I mean, over a course of 10 years, and this is in a counterculture that has 100 journals and magazines, many very short-lived, much poetry and kind of poetry soirees and the like. And so, you know, I like to ask what that literature is doing within this movement, what it's doing for these people, and then what drama and melodrama specifically is doing. And I think that part of it is about the form's capacity for exploring social relationships, imagining the ways that those are in flux and might change. And then also for kind of what Shannon Jackson talks about, the performance studies scholar, in writing about a contemporary performance, requiring participants to think deliberately, but also speculatively about what it means to sustain human collaboration.
So I'm really interested in the kind of relationship between, let's say, the emotional payoff of a melodramatic theatrical production and the emotional requirements that are needed to sustain a political movement, let's say. You know, in these benefits nights that you talk about, like, were these plays produced, you know, before the kind of main oratorical event, like the main speech, or like after, or, you know, were these like on separate nights?
Yeah, I mean, lots of different ways is where they occur. And I mean, and to me, it's really fascinating, the cultural embeddedness of performance. And so you might have a play or scenes from a play enacted at a soiree that features poetry readings, singing, maybe some ceremonial toasting, and then dancing. And it's, you know, just part of a kind of night of festivity. It's by, you know, often enough, mill workers in Lancashire, which is one of the kind of great centers of Chartist drama. Right. And, you know, people who are working kind of probably, I mean, 60, 70 hour weeks in mills. And so it's quite extraordinary, the efforts to put on a play, and then to also think what the freedom of that night might mean. Sometimes you might have an act of a play performed after a political rally, actually. Sometimes, a lot of these, especially in London, interestingly, are at commercial theaters. There isn't kind of quite the amateur drama culture in London, and potentially because of the relatively high production values of so much commercial theater. So it would just, be a benefit night performance where maybe an activist would say a little bit, or, really remarkably, I work on this, wrote an article about four theatrical fundraising nights for this group of political prisoners called the Dorchester Laborers, also known as the Tolpuddle Martyrs. But they were unionists sentenced in the mid-1830s for swearing secret oaths while trying to form a union. And they're transported to the Australian colonies, Van Diemen's Land or Tasmania, and Australia for 7 years. And there's a kind of massive campaign to get them back, which features, it really, wonderful and also theatrical kind of marches and the like. There's a silent march, which is really powerful and kind of genre breaking in its own right. But then there are four fundraising nights to raise money for their so-called widows and orphans, and then also for them upon their return. And the campaign's actually successful and kind of wins the remission of their sentence. But those occur at three London theaters, the Surrey and the Victoria, twice at the Victoria. Those are kind of southbound theaters, and then an East End theater. So these theaters in kind of working class neighborhoods and with working class audiences. And so, it is quite kind of fascinating to think about what the experience of the prisoners was like. Actually, at the final benefit performance, they appear on the stage at the end. Four of them come and are greeted, which leads to one gives a speech where he kind of explicitly calls for unions, and someone in the wings kind of crashes down the curtain on them to cut short the speech. So the kind of context of the possibility of a theater losing its license and theatrical censorship is pressing on it. But it's also quite remarkable because the plays are very radical. There's a play called The Mutiny at the Nore about the Jacobin mutiny in the 1790s. There's plays that kind of satirize the law and the like, and you can stage those, but you kind of can't explicitly articulate kind of what you're staging it for.
My final question, it will appear a little random, but it's coming. How will melodrama save the world?
Yeah, well, melodramas are always about worlds in need of saving. They're about plays themselves are about proliferating catastrophes and people caught up in systems that threaten to destroy them. And they're also about how the world might be saved, in that fundamental, the genre is peripety, the extraordinary turn in which everything changes and leading to the stereotyped melodramatic happy end. And it kind of, how to understand that happy end, I think it's difficult. An earlier generation saw it as kind of compensatory wish fulfillment for people kind of battered in their own lives, and they can enjoy, the fantastical Deus Ex Machina at the end. But recent scholarships has really complicated that in rich ways. So Michael Buckley kind of emphasizes the genre's psychological expressionism. The characters kind of navigate nightmare landscapes, and that's really the overwhelming experience of the plays. And then at the end, that might be recuperated. And then Carolyn Williams points out the fragility of the happy end. They're often kind of parodic and outlandish, like, at the end of Black Eyed Susan, one of the most popular nautical melodramas, one of the most popular plays of the 19th century, know, someone is condemned for striking an officer. He's, you know, a sailor, and he struck his officer, but to rescue his wife from a sexual assault. He had actually, unbeknownst to him or anyone, he had been discharged from the Navy. And at the very cannon that fires off before he's to be hung, a corpse of his villainous uncle kind of is drawn to the surface. They search the body and there are the discharge papers. So, you know, this kind of totally outlandish and seemingly parodic happy end is very fragile for Carolyn Williams. But I'd add that, you know, that outlandishness isn't only parodic, but it requires a leap into the absurd and a kind of a leap into different logics, which is interesting for me in terms of these political performances. And I like to think about how kind of the happy end and catastrophe are braided together in these kind of tight knots, and that they both end up seeming contingent. The catastrophe is what allows the peripety, because it shows you that's your selfhood is kind of inextricable to other people also in crisis. Well,
you know, that's a wonderful, I think. Greg, thank you so much for coming to High Theory and talking about melodrama. We deeply appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
And thank you for listening to High Theory.
If you like our podcast, please review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast fix.
Owen Quinn composes our theme music. Sharonic Bosu and Kim Adams edit our audio, and Sharonic Bosu manages our social media.
You can find High Theory on the New Books Network and also on hightheory.net.
We hope you have a highly theoretical day.